On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American democracy was never a perfect heaven, but big picture political scientist Alan Wolf is afraid it's now on a road to the perfect hell. Uninformed, emotional voters, manipulative, button-pushing politicians, few checks, no balances, and at stake, the very idea of democracy as Americans have known it, pluralistic, consensual, steady. In his new book, Does American Democracy Still Work?, Wolf warns there is a sickness in the body politic, lazy, naive, fearful voters, and a politics of fantasy. Both parties indulge, he says, but the ruling party has mastered the mix. Up next, On Point, where we're headed as a democracy and what to do about it. Joining me now in the studio is Alan Wolf. He's a widely respected professor of political science and director of the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College, author of Return to Greatness and One Nation After All. His new book is Does American Democracy Still Work? Alan Wolf, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Alan.
Hi, Jack.
Alan Wolf. A new politics and not a good one. What is it? You say there's a new politics of democracy. What's it look like?
Well, it doesn't look like the old politics. The old politics of democracy is something that I think certainly Americans of my age and older remember. It's when people in politics disagreed primarily about economics, primarily about foreign policy, when the Democrats stood for expanding the electorate and bringing new groups of voters into politics, whereas the Republicans stood for the interests of an old-fashioned elite. All that's gone now. Now it's the Republicans that actually claim to be the populist party that's in touch with ordinary feelings, and they accuse the Democrats of being the elite. And in addition, we're not arguing about economics and foreign policy, or at least we haven't been until recently. We argue about abortion, gay marriage, and stem cells.
So you describe a populace that in the information age is kind of ignorant, uninformed, easily swayed, with its emotions on its sleeve, and those emotions often, you know, those hot buttons pushed all the time. What's happened to the American people that's made them vulnerable to this kind of politics? Why should that have changed in an age where we're supposed to be better informed?
Well, you know, in some ways, I mean, I should make this clear from the beginning. The book is called Does American Democracy Still Work? And in some ways it really does. In fact, it works in ways that we all ought to be proud of. We are having an election in 2 weeks, and that's the way we change people in power, and that's an important thing to remember. We do have elections. We do have campaigns. Sometimes you actually learn something during a campaign. I mean, the trappings of democracy are still very much there. Most people have the right to vote. What I call in the book the quantitative features of democracy, an expanding electorate and so on, are still there, although there are always attempts to suppress voters and voting turnout. But by and large, anyone who wants to vote can.
So quantitative, not bad, that we'd like to see a bigger turnout.
We'd like to see a bigger turnout. And I personally I'm disturbed when people in state legislatures try to increase the requirement for voting with picture IDs and so on. And, of course, voting machine issues, those are always big. We have this problem where a secretary of state in a given state is a partisan and not just a – but by and large, we've solved the quantitative issues.
But where do you get to the quality issue? What leads you to believe that Americans are not well informed in an age when you can turn, you know, hit a button anywhere and learn a lot?
Well, that's one of the biggest of what I call the qualitative features. The political scientists measure sort of public ignorance, not so much opinions, because opinions are kind of interesting, obviously, but just basic facts. You know, how many political parties are there? Which one controls the House of Representatives? Who's the Speaker of the House? Now, you could dismiss those as trivia questions. But just to put it to you, Tom, this way, let's take the question, which party governs the House of Representatives? We have two parties. 50-50 chance we'll get it right. In fact, among young people, the number of people who got it wrong is higher.
Is this among voters or just among citizens at large?
This is just among citizens at large.
Okay, so they don't know if it's Republicans or Democrats.
They don't know if it's Republicans or Democrats. They can't identify the kinds of... I mean, one of the big controversies in the Bush administration at the beginning was over this Medicare bill with its donut hole provisions and so on.
About prescription drug coverage.
Prescription drugs. Most people don't know there was such a bill. They certainly don't know what features are in it. Now, these have always been... facts about American, but generally speaking, voters are not that informed. That's a given. That's just as true in 1850.
People have lives to lead, and they lead those, and that keeps them.
So
why is this a bigger problem now?
That's the thing I address in the book. Because ordinarily, I'm not one to come down hard on the American people. In my other books, I praised Americans for their good sense and their moral wisdom, which I think is actually exists in abundance. What happens is if people are ignorant at a time when politics is relatively consensual, there's no problem because most Americans are middle of the road. And if most politicians are middle of the road, they wind up on the same page. It doesn't matter that people don't follow. They wind up on the same page. Now, the American public and the leaders are not on the same page. They're not even reading from the same book. Because in what I call the new politics of democracy, you get really ideological leadership. They have an agenda, and they're driving it. In that context, public ignorance isn't just background noise. It's actually something you want to cultivate. You want to make people ignorant. You want to dispense falsehoods. You want to get people to believe the wrong things. That's when it becomes a serious issue.
I'm sure people may listen and say, wait a minute, what you're describing as ignorance is my ideology, my worldview. I want to ask you about that, Alan. But you say that if there's this ignorance, politicians then are leaning into it with appeals to emotion rather than to fact. What? The ignorance makes that easier, I guess, you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, look at the reaction to 9/11. We cannot have a debate over whether or not Saddam Hussein was responsible for Osama bin Laden and the attack on America. That's a factual question. Factually speaking, the charge that he was, which was repeated by Vice President Cheney over and over and over again, is just simply wrong. It's a lie. It's untrue. What you do when you get people that are cultivating ignorance is they're doing that because they want to appeal to an emotion. In this case, the emotion is fear. Now, politicians on all sides will do this, but what we've seen is a real increase in the willingness of politicians to simply work on public ignorance, to use public ignorance in order to achieve an ideological objective. That's what's different in the new politics.
Jack, come in with us here. It's never been a perfect paradise in American democracy. There are always rough edges in a big country like this with so many voters and potential voters and issues and politicians at work. Do you see something fundamentally different? What do you think of Alan's argument, Jack?
I think that he's got a lot of very profound things to say about the condition of our democracy here. I'm just wrestling with this, Alan. I've, for years, been, however long it's been citing your book, One Nation After All, to point out that, really, Americans have a general moral consensus about civil rights, about even abortion, about all sorts of things, perhaps not so much about homosexual rights. But generally, Americans are pretty much in the center. And yet the picture you draw in this book is of politics dividing over these issues when the public seems to be united over them. How do you explain that?
Well, thanks, Jack. I think it's a very good question. And I do address it in the book. I'm not questioning the basic decency of Americans who really have a remarkable way, I think, of coming to terms with some very, very contentious issues and splitting differences and finding compromises. I'm just saying that while appreciating that, it's always been the case, you know, that Americans, let's say that we're not avid consumers of newspapers. We generally speaking, trust our leaders. I know there's a lot of talk about cynicism in this country, but we actually are remarkably trustful of our leaders. And that gives our leaders a lot of opportunities. Now, I think that most of our great leaders have had the chance to really sort of take advantage of the ignorance that goes along with this kind of moral goodness. And they really haven't done so because they realize, you know, you can destroy a democracy if you do that. Right now, we are really witnessing efforts to take advantage of that ignorance, to sort of go beyond the common sense of the American people, which I think is very, very strong, and to try to get people, to manipulate people into positions that they're going to come to regret later on.
But is it at this point truly a divided populace or just a divided political class on these central cultural issues?
A divided political class, Tom, than a divided populace. There hasn't been much of a change. Look at the big issues out there, abortion, stem cells, and so on. Americans are still not as divided as we're constantly told. But the partisanship, the divisions in Congress, for example, are greater than ever. We've never had, not even, and Jack's a good historian, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, but not even in the golden age of past political leadership have we had such partisanship in Congress where one party unites completely on one side of the issue and the other party unites completely on the other side of the
issue. Jack, what do you think? Those great big mega churches full of people who may share a certain cultural values, are those not real factors here?
I think they're real factors, but I guess if you just look at the broad opinion surveys, they're in there, but that people do group toward the middle. I mean, it is interesting. There's a recent book out by Keith Poole and others pointing out how Congress has become much more polarized, and precisely because of the injection of these moral issues. Polarization judged by, how liberal a Democratic member is and how conservative a Republican member is. But look at this election. The Republicans who are going to lose, many of them, are the moderate Republicans. So that after the election, we're going to have even more of that. So the cure, an election, could actually produce an even more polarized Congress. And that kind of polarization is, I quite agree, almost unprecedented. We had a lot of it in the 19th century, but this is, and it's fed not by the people necessarily, but by the elites and by the media.
Let's take a call from Hartford, Connecticut. Jay is on the line. Hi, Jay, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I tend to agree with Mr. Wolf, but the question I would have is, what role does the private financing of the elections have to do with it? I know they just recently passed a law here in Connecticut to make elections publicly funded, and I'm wondering if you took some of the massive amounts of dollars for ad buys out, if it would alleviate some of this overly emotional button pressing out of the election.
Jay, let us pick it up. Ellen Wolf, how about it? I don't see this issue of campaign finance front and center in your analysis here. I mean, money matters, but you're pointing to a lot of other things. How do you factor it in?
Well, I do think money matters, and I would be a supporter of campaign finance reform. But, it's a minor step, relatively speaking. The huge and expensive negative ads that we witness, and I'm now witnessing in Massachusetts in the gubernatorial race, those will only stop when they're no longer effective. All reforms in the world won't cure them. They'll stop working when they just don't get any voters. Now, when will that happen? That will happen when people develop the ability to look through these negative ads and to see them. I mean, I'm sorry, but people who are running for office just simply aren't as evil as they're made out to be by one side or the other in this kind of negative advertising.
Let's take a call from Pauling, New York, and Carol. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I agree that the average American is so involved with their lives, the necessity, the day-to-day of living, that they don't have the opportunities or make the opportunities they need to become more educated. In the last couple of years, I've had the luxury of having more time to pay attention, and clearly, for some time in our country, the word quote-unquote politics has had a continuing negative connotation, and I think that feeds into a lot of Americans' apathy. In addition, so I think we need to do something to turn that around.
What is it? Do you see the politics of fear Ellen Wolf's talking about? Is there an alternate politics?
Profoundly. I think the 2004 presidential election was a referendum on how profoundly afraid people were and how politicians preyed on people's fears. As was mentioned earlier, I don't know if there should be controversy or we should just accept the fact that Saddam was not directly responsible for 9/11, and that we needed to concentrate our efforts on Afghanistan, and that there's considerable evidence that at the federal level that our current presidential administration, not just the president but the whole administration, or largely most of it, had its eye on going into Iraq at any excuse that they could find.
And now we're sure in there deep and up to our necks, and it's no fun. Carol, thanks for your call. Alan Wolf, let's cut right to the chase here. You say, Carol alludes to a kind of cycle into cynicism. You say that this people may not be informed, but then they get manipulated emotionally and they end up more withdrawn, a kind of a negative cycle here. Describe that for us.
Yeah. We've been talking a lot about information and whether people have the information they need to make informed choices. But information is just one of many criteria that democracy needs to meet if it's going to be successful. I call my chapter on this Democracy Without Information. But I also have a chapter called Democracy Without Accountability. Accountability is a second big factor. I've got five of them, but accountability is a second big factor. And the Carroll School really stimulates this because elections are for the purpose of holding people accountable for their actions. And you've got to have that. If you don't have accountability, you get lingering, festering sores taking place. And the biggest one is cynicism. The people just say, oh, that's the way politics always is. Well, I'm sorry, with all due respect, it's not always the case that administrations mislead a country into war. It's not always the case that administrations say X while they're doing Y or Z. People have to basically realize, Americans think that, hey, cynicism is like a sophisticated response because I know, I'm wise and I know it's all cynical. It's actually not a sophisticated reason. It's exactly what politicians who do not want to be held accountable for their actions would encourage cynicism, because cynicism does not permit accountability. So, we have a situation, the president simply doesn't call, like, the Secretary of Defense accountable for his mistakes. And then Americans increasingly have not been calling their politicians accountable. That's why 2006 is one of the most important elections, even though it's an off-year election. This is our accountability election.
But what is it about these new politics? I mean, we can see it. You got one party in charge, both houses of Congress and the White House, so at a very simple level. But you're saying there's something embedded in this, what you call a new politics, diminishes the authority, the appeal of accountability. Why? What's the dynamic?
Well,
there?
Part of it is just structural features. Politicians have learned to gerrymander districts so that they're not really facing competition. That's a big structural feature aspect of it. I mean, we have a two-party system, and it works by the fact that one party is supposed to challenge the other. The idea is that there will always be a loyal opposition. Our two-party system has worked pretty well at holding things holding people accountable over the years. Not perfectly, but pretty well. Again, Jack's the historian here, but I see things just like the polarization in Congress that are literally unprecedented with respect to accountability. The small number of seats in Congress that are really contested. Mm. The fact that in recent years, Democrats, the opposition party, have been completely excluded from any role in the shaping of legislation. The fact that both houses of Congress, the president, and now really the Supreme Court, are under the control of the same political ideology has pretty much obliterated checks and balances. That's why I say we're facing an accountability election in 2006, because voters will have a chance now to build some more accountability into the system by restoring checks and balances. It's a very, very important
moment. But will they, Jack?
Yeah, well, and unless they do, I mean, they have to do what the branches have not done. I saw the other day that in the Clinton administration, the Republican Congress issued over 1,000 subpoenas to members of the Clinton administration about one thing or another, or to documents and so on. This Republican Congress, vis-a-vis this president, they have not issued a single subpoena. That is a statistical, dramatic rendering of lack of accountability. And that, to me, is one of the big changes. We haven't had parliamentary government here. I mentioned in a show last week the Fulbright hearings in the 1960s. Senator Fulbright was a Democrat. The members of his committee were Democrats. And yet in the middle of the Vietnam War, they brought George Kennan and Walter Lippmann and all the leading thinkers and critics of the war together to talk about what we were doing there. That was accountability. There's been nothing like this from the Republicans.
Alan Wolf, let's cut to the chase on the party issue. You say there's a new politics. It appeals to, it takes advantage of ignorance. It appeals to emotion. You say both parties, Democrat and Republican, are guilty of it. So give us examples from each. But then you say in the end, you're much tougher on the Republicans. How do you see the balance?
Well, you know, politics is brutal business, and politics is kind of warfare by other means, and both parties are partisan. But the Republicans under Karl Rove have really understood the rules of what I call the new politics of democracy better than the Democrats. They're better at it. I'm praising them. I'm praising them for their ability to be focus on party unity and to achieve it. They've done a much better job.
And you're praising them for partisan utility, but not necessarily for the health of democracy.
Oh, no. They're very, very much responsible for serious diminution in the quality of American democracy. But you got to admire their political genius.
Don't jump to Karl Rove so quickly. Give us the Democratic examples. You look back at Bill Clinton, and you say in the book there are examples of this new politics at work there, too.
Yeah, I think, you know, the way Bill Clinton proposed some of his legislation was based upon focus groups and, you know, sort of tinkering and adjusting, not unlike the way Republicans do it. But again, I'm a kind of a centrist myself, and I like to find examples from both sides. But it's very hard to do that these days, again, because there's a real imbalance. Now, the imbalance is due in part to the fact that there are more conservatives in the United States than there are liberals.
Native inclination.
Right, yeah, so the base is bigger for Republicans. But, you know, look, one of the I've talked about democracy without information. Mm-hmm. I've talked about democracy without accountability. Another one of my chapters is called Democracy Without Institutions. And I argue that democracy really requires strong political parties. Mm-hmm. And you'll say, well, you know, parties have never been stronger. Actually, partisanship has never been stronger. But political parties have never been weaker. When we had strong parties, the era of Fulbright, you know, that Jack has mentioned, and so on, you had bipartisanship. Strong parties weren't afraid to form bipartisan coalitions. What we now have now are political parties that are hollowed out. They don't raise money. Candidates raise their own money. They don't have any real local organization of the way the Curley machine, that's Jack's specialty, the way the Curley machine
in Boston, out. The mayor who so famously
strong,
thought of the
strong,
law.
But locally rooted parties, those we don't have. Instead, we have partisanship instead of parties. So we have the appearance of institutions without actual institutions.
And those aren't the only institutions you say right. American democracy today is missing. What are the others? What are the other vacuums do you see there?
Well, you know, other people like Bob Putnam over at Harvard have written, you know, about bowling alone and all those things. I don't want to go over, you know, that well.
But you're saying unions and community
unions,
groups.
Exactly, and community groups. I mean, you know, one of the really interesting things for me about American politics, maybe because I lived in California for a decade, is that one institution Americans seem to love are referendums and direct elections. Those are the least institutional. People just go out and vote.
They become much more popular. So it's atomized voters just responding to a referendum.
That's right.
You're saying that's not as good as
having strong institutional base. I actually like the old political machines. I think they did a good job for democracy, especially in comparison to what we have now.
But we're in an age when, with the technology, partisan leaders can reach out and touch people individually and directly, never mind the intermediaries. Let's get another call. Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. Elizabeth is calling. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you hear, Elizabeth? What do you see?
I had a question for Tom. I'm a member of a nonpartisan organization in Charleston, South Carolina, and at a recent board meeting, folks decided that because voters don't have enough time to decide how to vote, that we informed folk should advise them of how we think they should vote, and I just wondered if you had any comment.
Well, and how do you do that, on the basis of party affiliation, or on the, how do you
not
decide what to recommend?
Not party affiliation, no. It is nonpartisan. And
so you look directly at the issues and weigh them yourselves and then give advice?
Exactly.
But who's your constituency? Is it a membership, or you're just kind of, is this like a League of Women Voters
exactly.
offering?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Alan Wolf, here's the old institutional model, where we who have time weigh the issues and recommend things to the public. Is that what you're missing, what Elizabeth's describing?
I think what Elizabeth describes is an interesting idea. I mean, I think we're missing a number of the things that are implied in her comment. We could use, for example, at least I believe we could use more leadership in this country. Democracy
at the local level.
The kind of almost nonpartisan expertise that she's talking about. I've talked about how we have a democracy without information, democracy without accountability, democracy without institutions. Another chapter in my book is called Democracy Without Disinterest. And what I mean by that is that we used to have experts that we relied on, and we relied on them because they were trusted as nonpartisan.
Such as? Kind of experts?
Journalists, for one thing, were often viewed in this way. Mm-hmm. Even my own field, even social scientists were viewed this way.
Research institutions.
But the very, very best example is what were called the wise men during the Johnson administration. When Lyndon Johnson, who faced a quagmire in Iraq, in Vietnam, there you go again, Alan. He faced a quagmire in Vietnam, and he brought in these distinguished experts, bipartisan experts who could advise him. Now, we see some of that now, with the so-called Baker.
James Baker Lee Hamilton.
But the interesting thing now is they're saying, well, we're not even going to report to after the election. God forbid we experts should have any influence before an election. God forbid our judgment should lead people to think about how they're going to vote. We'll wait until after the election. And who knows if the Bush administration is going to follow this. The Bush administration has never been a strong believer in the idea that disinterested information is possible on anything, global warming, drug testing, and so on.
So you're kind of you're missing the graybeards, the wise men, the intermediaries.
Yeah, right.
In some ways, that can sound anti-democratic.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you have a problem with populism? I mean, in a democracy where we've got technology that can get information to everyone, why shouldn't more direct involvement, not intermediated, be just A-OK?
I'm glad we cut to the chase, Tom. Yes, I have a problem with populism. Democracy means rule by the people. But that has never meant, or I don't think it ever ought to mean, that you don't have leadership. Leadership is what democracy requires to make sure not only that the people are heard, but that the decisions that a political system reaches are wise. We've had great leadership in the past. Abraham Lincoln was a great leader. Teddy Roosevelt was a great leader. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a great leader. See, I'm picking Republicans as well as Democrats. We much more, our political system now is structured to have followership rather than leadership. It almost makes leadership impossible because everything is so poll tested. Everything is so focus group. So the populism has taken over from the leadership. And yet Americans actually crave good leadership. I believe that they're desperate for someone who can appear to be really above the fray in some way and can speak to their better emotions. I'll tell you this much, Tom. I mean, this I'm sure of. This administration has proven that it really matters whether you know something factually about a country you're going to invade. That there are Shias or there are Sunnis. I mean, this administration has made a very good case for the fact that at least we ought to have experts in what Islam is like and what Muslim countries are like before we go in and tear the hell out of them and leave complete chaos behind.
Mildred's calling from Bristol, Rhode Island. Hi, Mildred, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm 76 years old, of course, when I was younger, the world impinged on us a lot more than I think it does of the teenagers of today. But we had the war. Second World War and the Depression, and I lived in blue-collar Detroit, where the union movement was very big, and there was a lot going on in that. But when I was in the 11th grade, we had an English teacher who had us go out and get all the publications we could, Time Magazine and the Atlantic Monthly and Nation and all the we had three papers from conservative to liberal.
Right, old days.
Then we had to read them and we had to compare the points of view that were on the same story and that kind of thing, and read them critically, and write a paper on what on the on where were the propaganda points, and what were the catchwords and so
wow.
forth?
So here's the making of an informed citizenry, a kind of and wise eye.
You know, this is not in a hoity-toity school, which is ordinary Central High School in Detroit.
But don't you think American classrooms are still doing that, or some of that today?
I wish they did. I don't know.
Alan Wolf, how about it? Is it a generational critique you're making here, or are contemporaries of Mildred, 76, in on the game as well?
Well, there are generational differences. The kind of thing we began with this morning about voter ignorance is in fact, stronger among younger people. But, you know, many of them probably will grow out of that. I remain actually something of an optimist. I do believe that younger people will realize that the last 6 years have been a time, I think whatever side of the issues you're on, that you learn how important politics really is. Let me just say, if I can jump back over Mildred to Jack Beatty. Jack Beatty said that, you know, Bush was a real leader in some ways, and I couldn't agree more. Bill Clinton just constantly seemed to think that somebody else was president of the United States.
But you just said we need more leadership.
We need more leadership. But
there's the leader. Is it just that you don't like the direction in which Bush
is leading?
Of course, Tom.
So let's not be naive about here. Direction also matters. Democracy requires that you do the right things, the wise things, that you not just lead for the sake of leadership.
But of course, George Bush would never describe it in that way.
I don't care what George Bush would describe it
as. Does that leave you as a partisan here rather than a sort of scientific analyst of what's going on? Is it just because
George
it's not marching in your direction?
George Bush has a direction. But in a democracy, you do need to ask the question, is this direction a smart one or a wise one? Hmm. I don't know anyone in the future that will believe that the directions that George Bush tried to establish were smart and wise. So, yes, you definitely—I mean, if I go back to Jack's point, Bush has shown that presidents really matter, mm-hmm. something that Democrats have had a hard time understanding. Mm-hmm. What you need is a combination of the notion that leadership really matters with wise and intelligent policies. We've had the one. We haven't had the other. But as I said, I'm an optimist, and I think that Bush, having shown that half of what you need is there— it's only a matter for smart leaders, and they don't have to be Democrats. They could be Republicans, although given the present composition of the Republican Party, I'm not so sure it'll happen there. But we need wise leaders, and that's the next step.
Jack Beatty, Alan Wolf says he's an optimist, but he's writing a scare-the-pants-off-you book here, which shows democracy in a kind of downward spiral, as he would say it, whichever party you're in.
Yes, but, you know, we're approaching an accountability moment. I think that's what the president said about the 2004 election. That was the accountability moment. Now leave me alone. Well, we're having another one, and we'll see. I mean, if this massive public discontent with Congress, 16% approval, gets translated into a massive loss for the governing party, I think then we'll have something like a responsive political system. If it doesn't, if incumbency and money and gerrymandering triumph and or build the wall high enough, I think that'll say something else. So I'm not optimistic. I'm neutral on that question, and you know, it's easy to think that the common sense of the people will triumph, and yet we have had an administration here and a government that has not used common sense, and yet it was Bush was elected, he's been reelected, the Republican. Everything has been ideological. It's how we think the reality should be as opposed to what reality should be. The other day, Barack Obama on Meet the Press said, you know, can't we just use facts? You know, can't we just talk about the world as it is? Is that so radical?
But Jack,
and yet, this crew has really made that seem radical.
We hear you and Alan both on that theme. But Jack, you're an historian. This was a crew, as you call it, that came in saying, look, we're not prisoners of the reality-based crowd. We want to move American life and American politics into a different part of the spectrum here. We deliberately want to move this country in a different direction. So, yes, we're going to look at things differently. We're going to interpret things differently. We're going to fix our course on different stars. Has that happened before in American history? Is that necessarily anti-democratic?
It's anti-rational. I mean, you can be conservative and rational, but it's not rational to take this all the State Department's plans about the transition in Iraq and to say we don't need to look at these and just throw them away. That's not rational. And that's what I mean. I mean, there could be a very rational conservatism that respected. In fact, that's what conservatives have said about liberals for decades. Liberals don't pay attention to the real world. Well, we've just seen a conservative administration that doesn't.
Let's take a call from Buffalo, New York. Christine's on the line. Hi, Christine. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi,
Alan Wolf.
Thank you, Christine,
so much for writing this book. I don't know of a more important conversation to be having right now than the health of democracy. And I've been really interested in the role of the press, and I'd like to get your feedback on that. I feel like the press is a critical piece to making democracy work. And unless the press is obligated, and I think I'm talking especially about local press, unless they're obligated to cover politics, then they won't be equipped to cover politics. And therefore, the politicians will then depend on ads to communicate with the voters. But then the press also benefits from that ad revenue. And that ad revenue comes from all of the kind of third wheels of politics, the suspicions that politicians create when they take money from other people.
Christine, let me ask you, do you feel your local press in Buffalo backing away from covering politics? You've got hot politics there. They must be all over it.
Yes, but I think it's the way that it's covered.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way to cover politics that is incendiary and emotional. And there's a way of covering politics saying, okay, what is it this person's supposed to be doing? Is this person living up to their job description? Are they being held accountable day by day, or is it just a year-to-year, election-by-election kind of thing?
Mm. Christine, let us pick it up. Alan Wolf, we skipped pretty quickly over Democracy Without Information, your chapter title. I mean, these days, just to keep newspapers alive in some towns, it seems like an accomplishment. But Christine wants more. How do you see the role of the press in this devolution of democracy you describe?
Well, the press is obviously important in providing information. It's just as important in providing what I call disinterest, in providing a perspective that is trusted by people because it seemed to be above the fray of political conflict. The disinterest is also, you know, both sides of the press have been facing real serious problems.
Sides of the press?
Both of these things, both providing information and being disinterested. We've gotten much more market-driven forces going on where newspapers are part of conglomeratization, and it's not enough to just make a profit. You've got to make a super profit. And, you know, my favorite example these days is the L.A. Times, which has lost an editor and has just redesigned its front page to make it sexier and more appealing. I mean, so there are trends going on in the press that aren't particularly helpful for democracy. But I think the biggest one is that Republicans and conservatives have done a pretty good job persuading people that there are only two points of view, a liberal point of view and a conservative point of view. We used to believe that there were three. There were liberals, there were conservatives, and there were people who were neutral. Conservatives say that anyone who's neutral is really a liberal. And that's actually gotten a lot of traction, and a lot of the press has come to believe that as well. So in the first 6 years of the – or first 4 or 5 years of the Bush administration, the press sort of feeling that it was perceived as too liberal really gave this administration a free hand. And as a result, another institution of accountability was kind of undermined. So all these things, accountability, information, disinterest, they all go together. Now I think the press has really woken up. I mean, right now, this week's news is that the Bush administration has decided to change course in Iraq radically, not by doing anything different, but simply by calling it a different thing. We're no longer going to say, you know, what's the phrase?
Our policy is now dynamic.
Right.
The state of the course
right.
is dynamic,
right.
Tony Snow.
Yeah, Tony Snow. And the press is really sort of all over the Bush administration on this and pointing out the way they just simply change rhetoric without ever changing anything. So the press is beginning to play that role. One reason why I'm more optimistic. And by the way, I completely endorse what Jack said. 2006 is a huge election in our history because it really is an election about accountability.
You say you're optimistic, but you describe some pretty bleak possibilities here, so that the stakes, as you see them, are on the table. If the pendulum doesn't swing, at least in terms of accountability and disinterested overview and the rest, what's the danger here? I mean, you're not happy with where politics stand now. Where could it go? Where
well,
could it descend?
It's a good question because, as I said, 2006 turns out that people have sort of woken up and they're voting on a more fact-based things and so on, it'll be healthy. But if it doesn't, if the election just becomes one more election in which sort of fear triumphs and incumbency triumphs, the lesson that policymakers are going to take from that is they can basically get away with anything, and 2006 could be a huge spiral downward. Right now, though, the polls really are seem pretty clear. Now, I'm not a great predictor, and I've over-predicted in the past, but you know, I'd be really, really shocked if at least one House of Congress didn't change hands in 2006, and that'll at least begin to introduce an element of accountability.
What do you say, Alan Wolf, to the listener out there who's thinking to him or herself, you know, Professor Wolf, I'm a Republican, and yes, this administration has made some mistakes and maybe some big ones, but I essentially like their gut. I like where I feel them headed. You know, you've got a huge theory here that just pushes against my party, but this is what I want.
Then vote Republican. I mean, there certainly are a lot of people in this country that vote Republican. I would
but,
never
But is that necessarily that. A foolish voter? Is that necessarily an ignorant voter? Or is it simply a voter who wants to lean toward a different vision of the future than you may have in mind?
There are certainly different visions, and I actually have voted Republican more than once in my life. And I'm one of those liberals and Democrats who's known to be, you know, pretty centrist and pretty moderate. I have lots of Republican friends and so on. But I would have to say that at this point, to reelect an administration that has made so many disastrous mistakes and that has lied about it so consistently from the beginning is a little more than just a policy difference. I think it represents an abdication of a citizen's responsibility. I think all American citizens, Republican or Democratic, should want to restore separation of powers and the balance of powers in this country right now. Otherwise, we'll have serious abuse. Tom, we haven't even talked about suspension of habeas corpus. Mm. And those. I think all Americans, Republican and Democrat, have an interest in seeing at least one House of Congress held by the other party.
Let's take a call from Manchester, New Hampshire. Mark's on the line. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just calling because I had a question and kind of a comment for Mr. Wolf. I worked in a Get Out the Vote campaign in the 2004 election, and we tried to approach the issue from, although a lot of us were left-leaning, we tried to approach the issue from a nonpartisan standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the University of New Hampshire, we had discovered that in the 2000 election, very few students had voted.
So you had a just the facts, ma'am, approach. How did it work?
Basically, we invited all the different candidates for both local, congressional, and presidential spots to give us as much information as they wanted. We put together sort of a table in different hotspots around campus to try and disperse as much information and to encourage students to vote.
So, Mark, you're right down at the nub of it here. Did you find this persuasive for people? Did they want to get into the facts, or did you see the kind of electorate Alan Wolf describes, more emotionally driven, can't be bothered with the facts?
I found that about one student in 10 really actually cared about the facts, and most times that one in the 10 already knew, was already informed. The other 9 were what I would call dangerously either uninformed, misinformed, and really dealt with the push-button, fear-motivated politics that Alan's talking about.
Mark, our time is short. Alan Wolf, there's a report right from the front lines, and that's a tough report. He's saying, look, people are voting on this because that's where their heads are at. They're emotional about it. They're ideologically driven themselves, and these are American voters.
Well, I'm glad to have empirical confirmation of the thesis in my book, but I'm not happy for the future of democracy if what we're hearing from New Hampshire turns out to be true across the board.
Jack, we've just got a minute. A final thought here on Alan Wolf's putting the spade in, what he turns up.
Well, we didn't get around to his chapter on democracy without justice, and I think that, to me, is the significant difference in this administration. It is not concerned with what typically has been called social justice. The only time the president that I know has used the word something is unfair was the double taxation of dividends. That's unfair. But the minimum wage on raise, that's not unfair. There's been an inversion here of our usual sense, coming out of really the Judeo-Christian tradition, of what's fairness. Fairness is usually thinking about the least advantaged, and that has not been Allen goes so far as to say the administration is interested in injustice, but it certainly hasn't been interested in justice.
Allen Wolf, final word on justice, democracy,
thanks for getting in
American
the fifth
way.
Of my chapters, Jack. I agree. I love that chapter.
Justice. It's a watch out or we will have a society far more coarse, indifferent, corrupt, and ugly. Well, interpret Allen Wolf as you will, but it's a strong thesis. Professor Wolf, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's always a pleasure.
The new book is Does American Democracy Still Work? Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.